Lots of food will walk. Miss Flitworth sat up in bed. On the edge of dreams, she'd heard another noise, which must have woken the cockerel. She fiddled with a match until she got a candle alight, and then felt under the bed, and her fingers found the hilt of a cutlass that had been much employed by the late Mr. Flitworth during his business trips across the mountains. She hurried down the creaking stairs and out into the chill of the dawn. She hesitated at the barn door, and then pulled it open just enough to step inside.
"Mr. Dawe?"
There was a rustle in the hay, and then an alert silence.
"Miss Flitworth?"
"Did you call out? I'm sure I heard someone shout my name."
There was another rustle, and Bill Dawe's head appeared over the edge of the loft.
"Miss Flitworth?"
"Yes. Who did you expect? Are you all right?"
Yes. Yes, I believe so."
"Are you sure you're all right? You woke up Cyril."
"Yes. Yes, it was just... I thought that... yes."
She blew out the candle. There was already enough pre-dawn light to see by.
"Well, if you're sure, now I'm up, I may as well put the porridge on."
Bill Dawe lay back on the hay until he felt he could trust his legs to carry him, and then climbed down and tottered across the yard to the farmhouse. He said nothing while she ladled porridge into a bowl in front of him and drowned it with cream. Finally, he couldn't contain himself any longer. He didn't know how to ask the questions, but he really needed the answers.
"Miss Flitworth?"
"Yes?"
"What is it in the night when you see things, but they are not the real thing?"
She stood, porridge pot in one hand and ladle in the other.
"Oh, you mean dreaming?" she said.
"Is that what dreaming is?"
"Don't you dream? I thought everyone dreamed."
"About things that are going to happen?"
"No, that's premonition, that is. I've never believed in 'em myself. You're not telling me you don't know what dreams are?"
"No, no, of course not."
"What's worrying you, Bill?"
"I suddenly know that we are going to die."
She watched him thoughtfully.
"Well, so does everyone," she said. "And that's what you've been dreaming about, is it? Everyone feels like this sometimes. I wouldn't worry about it if I were you. The best thing to do is keep busy and act cheerful, I always say."
"But we will come to an end."
"Oh, I don't know about that," said Miss Flitworth. "It all depends on what kind of life you've led, I suppose."
"I'm sorry?"
"Are you a religious man?"
"You mean that what happens to you when you die is what you believe will happen?"
"It would be nice if that was the case, wouldn't it?" she said brightly.
"But you see, I know what I believe. I believe nothing."
"We are gloomy this morning, aren't we?" said Miss Flitworth. "Best thing you could do right now is finish off that porridge. It's good for you. They say it builds healthy bones."
Bill Dawe looked down at the bowl.
"Can I have some more?"
Bill Dawe spent the morning chopping wood. It was pleasantly monotonous. Get tired. That was important. He must have slept before last night, but he must have been so tired that he didn't dream, and he was determined not to dream again. The axe rose and fell on the logs like clockwork. No, not like clockwork. Miss Flitworth had several pots on the stove when he came in.
"It smells good," Bill volunteered.
He reached for a wobbling pot lid. Miss Flitworth spun around.
"Don't touch it. You don't want that stuff. It's for the rats."
"Do rats not feed themselves?"
"You bet they do. That's why we're going to give them a little extra something before the harvest. A few dollops of this around the holes, and no more rats."
It took a little while for Bill Dawe to put two and two together, but when this took place, it was like megaliths mating.
"This is poison?"
"Essence of spickle mixed with oatmeal. Never fails."
"And they die?"
"Instantly. Straight over and legs in the air. We're having bread and cheese," she added. "I ain't doing big cooking twice in one day, and we're having chicken tonight. Talking of chicken, in fact... come on."
She took a cleaver off the rack and went out into the yard. Cyril, the cockerel, eyed her suspiciously from the top of the midden. His harem of fat and rather elderly hens, who had been scratching up the dust, bounded unsteadily towards Miss Flitworth in the broken knicker-elastic run of hens everywhere. She reached down quickly and picked one up. It regarded Bill Dawe with bright, stupid eyes.
"Do you know how to pluck a chicken?" said Miss Flitworth.
Bill looked from her to the hen.
But we feed them, he said helplessly.
That's right, and then they feed us. This one's been off lay for months. That's how it goes in the chicken world. Mr. Flitworth used to wring their necks, but I never got the knack of that. The cleaver's messy, and they run around a bit afterwards, but they did all right, and they know it.
Bildor considered his options. The chicken had focused one beady eye on him. Chickens are a lot more stupid than humans, and don't have the sophisticated mental filters that prevent them seeing what is truly there. It knew where it was, and who it was looking at. He looked into its small and simple life, and saw the last few seconds pouring away. He'd never killed. He'd taken life, but only when it was finished with. There was a difference between theft and stealing by finding.
"Not the cleaver," he said wearily. "Give me the chicken."
He turned his back for a moment, then handed the limp body to Miss Flitworth.
"Well done," she said, and went back to the kitchen.
Bildor felt Cyril's accusing gaze on him. He opened his hand. A tiny spot of light hovered over his palm. He blew on it gently and it faded away. After lunch, they put down the rat poison. He felt like a murderer. A lot of rats died. Down in the runs under the barn, in the deepest one, one tunnelled long ago by long-forgotten ancestral rodents, something appeared in the darkness. It seemed to have difficulty deciding what shape it was going to be. It began as a lump of highly suspicious cheese. This didn't seem to work. Then it tried something that looked very much like a small, hungry terrier. This was also rejected. For a moment it was a steel-jawed trap. This was clearly unsuitable. It cast around for fresh ideas, and much to its surprise, one arrived smoothly, as if travelling from no distance at all, not so much a shape as a memory of a shape. It tried and found that, while totally wrong for the job, in some deeply satisfying way, it was the only shape it could possibly be. It went to work. That evening, the men were practising archery on the green. Bildor had carefully ensured a local reputation as the worst bowman in the entire history of toxophily. It had never occurred to anyone that putting arrows through the hats of bystanders behind him must logically take a lot more skill than merely sending them through a quite large target a mere 50 yards away. It was amazing how many friends you could make by being bad at things, provided you were bad enough to be funny. So he was allowed to sit on a bench outside the inn with the old men. Next door, sparks poured from the chimney of the village smithy and spiralled up into the dusk. There was a ferocious hammering from behind its closed doors. Bildor wondered why the smithy was always shut. Most smiths worked with the doors open, so that their forge became an unofficial village meeting room. This one was keen on his work.
"Hello, Skellington,"
he swivelled round. The small child of the house was watching him with the most penetrating gaze he'd ever seen.
"You are a Skellington, aren't you?"
she said.
"I can tell because of the bones."
"You are mistaken, small child."
"You are. People turn into Skellingtons when they're dead. They're not supposed to walk around afterwards."
"Ha, ha, ha. Will you hark at the child?"
"Why are you walking around then?"
Bildor looked at the old men. They appeared engrossed in the sport.
"I'll tell you what," he said desperately. "If you will go away, I will give you a half penny."
"I've got a Skellington mask for when we go trick-or-treating on Soul Cake Night," she said. "It's made of paper. You get given sweets."
Bildor made the mistake millions of people had tried before with small children in slightly similar circumstances. He resorted to reason.
"Look," he said, "if I was really a skeleton, little girl, I'm sure these old gentlemen here would have something to say about it."
She regarded the old man at the other end of the bench.
"They're nearly Skellingtons anyway," she said. "I shouldn't think they'd want to see another one."
He gave in.
"I have to admit that you are right on that point."
"Why don't you fall to bits?"
"I don't know. I never have."
"I've seen skeletons of birds and things, and they fall to bits."
"Perhaps it is because they are what something was, whereas this is what I am."
"The apothecary who does medicine over in Chambly's got a skeleton on a hook, with all wire to hold the bones together,"
said the child, with the air of one imparting information gained after diligent research.
"I don't have wires."
"There's a difference between alive skeletons and dead ones."
"Yes."
"It's a dead Skellington he's got, then, is it?"
"Yes."
What was inside someone?
Yes.
Yuck.
The child stared distantly at the landscape for a while and then said,
I've got new socks.
Yes?
You can look if you like.
A grubby foot was extended for inspection.
Well, well. Fancy that. New socks.
My mum knitted them out of sheep.
My word.
The horizon was given another inspection.
Do you know, she said, do you know, it's Friday.
Yes.
I found a spoon.
Bill Dorr found he was waiting expectantly. He was not familiar with people who had an attention span of less than 3 seconds.
You work along with Miss Flitworth's?
Yes.
My dad says you've got your feet properly under the table there.
Bill Dorr couldn't think of an answer to this because he didn't know what it meant. It was one of those many flat statements humans made that were really just a disguise for something more subtle, which was often conveyed merely by the tone of voice or a look in the eyes, neither of which was being done by the child.
My dad says she said she's got boxes of treasure.
Has she?
I've got tuppence.
My goodness. Sal?
They both looked up as Mrs. Lifton appeared on the doorstep.
Bedtime for you. Stop worrying, Mr. Dorr.
Oh, I assure you, she is not. Say good night now.
How do skeletons go to sleep? They can't close their eyes, because...
He heard their voices muffled inside the inn.
You mustn't call Mr. Dorr that just because he's very thin.
It's all right. He's not the dead sort.
Mrs. Lifton's voice had the familiar worried tones of someone who can't bring themselves to believe the evidence of their own eyes.
Perhaps he's just been very ill.
I should think he's just about been as ill as he can be ever.
Bill Dorr walked back home thoughtfully. There was a light on in the farmhouse kitchen, but he went straight to the barn, climbed the ladder to the hayloft, and lay down. He could put off dreaming, but he couldn't escape remembering. He stared at the darkness. After a while, he was aware of the pattering of feet. He turned. A stream of pale rat-shaped ghosts skipped along the roof beam above his head, fading as they ran, so that soon there was nothing but the sound of the scampering. They were followed by a shape. It was about 6 inches high, it wore a black robe, it held a small scythe in one skeletal paw. A bone-white nose with brittle grey whiskers protruded from the shadowy hood. Bill Dorr reached out and picked it up. It didn't resist, but stood on the palm of his hand and eyed him as one professional to another.
Bill Dorr said, "And you are?"
The Death of Rats nodded.
Squeak.
I remember, said Bill Dorr, when you were a part of me.
The Death of Rats squeaked again. Bill Dorr fumbled in the pockets of his overall. He'd put some of his lunch in there. Ah, yes.
I expect, he said, that you could murder a piece of cheese.
The Death of Rats took it graciously. Bill Dorr remembered visiting an old man once, only once, who had spent his entire life locked in a cell in a tower for some alleged crime or other, and had tamed little birds for company during his life sentence. They crapped on his bedding and ate his food, but he tolerated them, and smiled at their flight in and out of the high-barred windows. Death had wondered at the time why anyone would do something like that.
"I won't delay you," he said. "I expect you've got things to do, rats to see. I know how it is."
And now he understood. He put the figure back on the beam and lay down in the hay.
"Drop in any time you're passing."
Bill Dorr stared at the darkness again. Sleep. He could feel her prowling around, sleep with a pocket full of dreams. He lay in the darkness and fought back. Miss Flitworth's shouting jolted him upright, and to his momentary relief still went on. The barn door slammed open.
"Bill, come down, quick!"
He swung his legs onto the ladder.
"What is happening, Miss Flitworth?"
"Something's on fire!"
They ran across the yard and out onto the road. The sky over the village was red.
"Come on!"
"But it is not our fire."
"It's going to be everyone's. It spreads like crazy on thatch."
They reached the apology for a town square. The inn was already well alight, the thatch roaring starwards in a million twisting sparks.
"Look at everyone standing around,"
snarled Miss Flitworth.
"There's the pump. Buckets are everywhere. Why don't people think?"
There was a scuffle a little way away as a couple of his customers tried to stop Lifton from running into the building. He was screaming at them.
"The girl's still in there," said Miss Flitworth. "Is that what he said?"
"Yes."
Flames curtained every upper window.
"There's got to be some way," said Miss Flitworth. "Maybe we could find a ladder."
"We should not."
"What? We've got to try. We can't leave people in there."
"You don't understand," said Bildor. "To tinker with the fate of one individual could destroy the whole world."
Miss Flitworth looked at him as if he'd gone mad.
"What kind of garbage is that?"
"I mean that there is a time for everyone to die."
She stared. Then she drew her hand back and gave him a ringing slap across the face. He was harder than she'd expected. She yelped and sucked at her knuckles.
"You leave my farm tonight, Mr. Bildor," she growled. "Understand?"
Then she turned on her heel and ran towards the pump. Some of the men had brought long hooks to drag the burning thatch off the roof. Miss Flitworth organized a team to get a ladder up to one of the bedroom windows, but by the time a man was persuaded to climb it behind the steaming protection of a damp blanket, the top of the ladder was already smouldering. Bildor watched the flames. He reached into his pocket and pulled out the golden timer. The firelight glowed redly on the glass. He put it away again. Part of the roof fell in.
Squeak!
Bildor looked down. A small robed figure marched between his legs and strutted into the flaming doorway. Someone was yelling something about barrels of brandy. Bildor reached back into his pocket and took out the timer again. Its hissing drowned out the roar of the flames. The future flowed into the past, and there was a lot more past than there was future, but he was struck by the fact that what it flowed through all the time was now. He replaced it carefully. Death knew that to tinker with the fate of one individual could destroy the whole world. He knew this. The knowledge was built into him. To Bildor, he realized, it was so much horse elbows.
"Oh, damn," he said, and walked into the fire.
"It's me, librarian,"
said Windle, trying to shout through the keyhole.
"Windle Poons."
He tried hammering some more.
"Why won't he answer?"
"Don't know,"
said a voice behind him.
"Schleppel?"
"Yes, Mr. Poons."
"Why are you behind me?"
"I've got to be behind something, Mr. Poons. That's what being a bogeyman is all about."
"Librarian,"
said Windle, hammering some more.
"Ook? Why won't you let me in?" "Ook? But I need to look something up." "Ook, ook." "Well, yes, I am. What's that got to do with it?" "Ook." That's unfair."
"What's he saying, Mr. Poons?"
"He won't let me in because I'm dead."
"That's typical. That's the sort of thing Red Shoe is always going on about, you know."
"Is there anyone else that knows about life force?"
"There's always Mrs. Cake, I suppose, but she's a bit weird."
"Who's Mrs. Cake?"
Then Windle realized what Schleppel had just said.
"Anyway, you're a bogeyman."
"You never heard of Mrs. Cake?"
"No."
"I don't suppose she's interested in magic. Anyway, Mr. Shoe says we shouldn't talk to her. She exploits dead people, he says."
"How?"
"She's a medium. Well, more a small."
"Really? All right, let's go and see her. And, Schleppel?"
"Yes?"
"It's creepy feeling you standing behind me the whole time."
"I get very upset if I'm not behind something, Mr. Poons."
"Can't you lurk behind something else?"
"What do you suggest, Mr. Poons?"
Windle thought about it.
"Yes, it might work," he said quietly, "if I can find a screwdriver."
Modo the gardener was on his knees mulching the dahlias when he heard a rhythmic scraping and thumping behind him, such as might be made by someone trying to move a heavy object. He turned his head.
"Evening, Mr. Poons. Still dead, I see."
"Evening, Modo. You've got the place looking very nice."
"There's someone moving a door along behind you, Mr. Poons."
"Yes, I know."
The door edged cautiously along the path. As it passed Modo, it pivoted awkwardly, as if whoever was carrying it was trying to keep as much behind it as possible.
"It's a kind of a security door,"
said Windle. He paused, There was something wrong. He couldn't quite be certain what it was, but there was suddenly a lot of wrongness about, like hearing one note out of tune in an orchestra. He audited the view in front of him.
"What's that you're putting the weeds into?"
he said. Modo glanced at the thing beside him.
"Good, isn't it?" he said. "I found it by the compost heaps. My wheelbarrow broke, so I looked up, and there..."
"I've never seen anything like it before," said Windle. "Who'd want to make a big basket out of wire? And those wheels don't look big enough."
"But it pushes along well by the handle," said Modo. "I'm amazed that anyone would want to throw it away. Why would anyone want to throw away something like this, Mr. Poons?"
Windle stared at the trolley. He couldn't escape the feeling that it was watching him. He heard himself say,
"Maybe it got there by itself."
"That's right, Mr. Poons. It wanted a bit of peace, I expect," said Modo. "You are a one."
"Yes," said Windle unhappily. "It rather looks that way."
He stepped out into the city, aware of the scraping and thumping of the door behind him. If someone had told me a month ago, he thought, that a few days after I died I'd be walking along the road followed by a bashful bogeyman hiding behind the door, why, I'd have laughed at them. No, I wouldn't. I'd have said, "They? And what? And speak up?" and wouldn't have understood anyway. Beside him, someone barked. A dog was watching him. It was a very large dog. In fact, the only reason it could be called a dog and not a wolf was that everyone knew you didn't get wolves in cities. It winked. Windle thought,
"No full moon last night."
"Lupine?" he ventured. The dog nodded.
"Can you talk?"
The dog shook its head.
"So what do you do now?"
Lupine shrugged.
"Want to come with me?"
There was another shrug that almost vocalized the thought, "Why not? What else have I got to do?" If someone had told me a month ago, Windle thought, that a few days after I died I'd be walking along the road, followed by a bashful bogeyman hiding behind a door, and accompanied by a kind of negative version of a werewolf, why, I probably would have laughed at them. After they'd repeated themselves a few times, of course, in a loud voice. The death of rats rounded up the last of his clients, many of whom had been in the thatch, and led the way through the flames towards wherever it was that good rats went. He was surprised to pass a burning figure forcing its way through the incandescent mess of collapsed beams and crumbling floorboards. As it mounted the blazing stairs, it removed something from the disintegrating remains of its clothing and held it carefully in its teeth. The death of rats did not wait to see what happened next. While it was in some respects as ancient as the first proto-rat, it was also less than a day old and still feeling its way as a death, and it was probably aware that a deep thumping noise that was making the building shake was the sound of brandy starting to boil in its barrels. The thing about boiling brandy is that it doesn't boil for long. The fireball dropped bits of the inn half a mile away. White, hot flames erupted from the holes where the doors and windows had been. The walls exploded. Burning rafters whirred overhead. Some buried themselves in neighbouring roofs, starting more fires. What was left was just an eye-watering glow. And then little pools of shadow within the glow. They moved and ran together and formed the shape of a tall figure striding forward, carrying something in front of it. It passed through the blistered crowd and trudged up the cool, dark road towards the farm. The people picked themselves up and followed it, moving through the dusk like the tail of a dark comet. Bill Dawe climbed the stairs to Miss Flitworth's bedroom and laid the child on the bed.
"She said there was an apothecary somewhere near here."
Miss Flitworth pushed her way through the crowd at the top of the stairs.
"There's one in Chambly," she said, "but there's a witch over Lankaway."
"No witches, no magic. Send for him, and everyone else, go away."
It wasn't a suggestion. It wasn't even a command, it was simply an irrefutable statement. Miss Flitworth waved her skinny arms at the people.
"Come on, come on, it's all over. Shoo! You're all in my bedroom. Go on, get out."
"How did he do it?"
said someone in the back of the crowd.
"No one could have got out of there alive. We saw it all blow up."
Bill Dawe turned around slowly.
"We hid," he said, "in the cellar."
"There, see," said Miss Flitworth. "In the cellar, makes sense."
"But the inn hasn't got..."
The doubter began and stopped. Bill Dawe was glaring at him.
"In the cellar,"
he corrected himself.
"Yeah, right. Clever. Very clever,"
said Miss Flitworth. "Now get along with the lot of you." He heard her shoo them down the stairs and back into the night. The door slammed. He didn't hear her come back up the stairs with a bowl of cold water and a flannel. Miss Flitworth could walk lightly, too, when she had a mind to. She came in and shut the door behind her.
"Her parents'll want to see her," she said. "Her mum's in a faint, and Big Henry from the mill knocked her dad out when he tried to run into the flames. But they'll be here directly."
She bent down and ran the flannel over the girl's forehead.
"Where was she?"
"She was hiding in a cupboard."
"From a fire?"
Bildore shrugged.
"I'm amazed you could find anyone in all that heat and smoke," she said.
"I suppose you could call it a knack."
"And not a mark on her."
Bildore ignored the question in her voice.
"Did you send someone for the apothecary?"
"Yes."
"He must not take anything away."
"What do you mean?"
"Stay here when he comes. You must not take anything out of this room."
"That's silly. Why should he take anything? What would he want to take?"
"It is very important. And now I must leave you."
"Where are you going?"
"To the barn. There are things I must do. There may not be much time now."
Miss Flitworth stared at the small figure on the bed. She felt far out of her depth, and all she could do was tread water.
"She just looks as if she's sleeping," she said helplessly.
"What's wrong with her?" Bildore paused at the top of the stairs.
"She is living on borrowed time," he said.